Welcome back to Bullet Points.
Beatrice Huser is a historian and political scientist and the current chair of international relations at the University of Glasgow. Huser specializes in strategic studies, specifically nuclear strategy, strategic theory, and strategic culture, in addition to transatlantic relations in foreign and defense policy. From 1991 to 2003, she taught at the Department of War Studies and served as the chair of international and strategic studies at the King's College London. From 1997 to 1998, she worked in the international staff at NATO headquarters in Brussels. And from 2003 to 2007, she worked at the Director for Research at the Military Research History Research Office in Potsdam. Huser's publications include NATO, Britain, France, and the FRG, Nuclear Strategies and Forces for Europe, Nuclear Mentalities, and The Bomb, Nuclear Weapons in Their Historical, Strategic, and Ethical Context, among many others. Thank you so much, Professor Huser, and welcome.
Thank you very much.
So just to start off with a general question. How did you become interested in the study of military strategies and warfare?
In two different ways. I was born and grew up in Thailand, and I lived in Thailand while the Vietnam War was going on very nearby and was spilling from Vietnam into Cambodia and from Cambodia even into Thailand across the borders with some small incursions and border struggles. And basically that made me very worried at the time that we would have war in Thailand as well. And the second thing was that my parents had lived in Germany. They were Germans and they lived in Germany during the Second World War. And from my earliest youth, they kept telling me what an absolutely horrendous thing war was and all the terrible consequences of war and how that was just the worst thing in the world.
Wow. Fascinating. You write about the question of victory in a nuclear war. And what makes victory difficult in nuclear war? And is there a scenario where a nuclear war can truly be won?
There are many definitions of victory, but the assumption behind practically all those definitions is that somehow the victor is better off at the end than they would be if they hadn't gone to war, if they hadn't fought that war, and if they hadn't come out of that war. Now, the point about nuclear weapons is, of course, that if they are used and if it escalates to pretty extensive usage, the numbers of casualties will be so high that even in the Cold War, even Soviet strategists began to think that there could be no meaningful victory because the end state would be so horrendous that you couldn't really celebrate your triumph in any way because there'd simply be too many dead to mourn. And that's particularly poignant for the Soviet Union and the Soviet strategists who took a long time conceding that because, of course, the Soviet Union is the country in Europe that had the most victims in the Second World War. And they're even today, in my view, not at all over the death rate they had in the Second World War, although they constantly celebrate the victory they had in the Second World War recently with this big march to celebrate its anniversary.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, speaking of these, this question of victory, how have strategies of deterrence in nuclear foreign policy changed overall foreign policy since 1945 with the first dropping of the atomic bomb?
There has been an element of deterrence in strategy throughout history. Deterrence in itself is something old, but as you rightly pointed out, it changed in quality to some extent with the dropping of the first atom bomb and then the possibility of that being repeated in some way. There is an existential threat now underlying the confrontation with any nuclear power ever since, because there's been this threat not only of saying you might enter into war with them, you might have a prolonged war, you might even defeat it, but there is this danger, obviously, given the power of nuclear weapons, that you might end up with your population so decimated that there'll only be a small proportion left, or a proportion that is, you know, half the population that there was before, and that the rest of the country will be so devastated and so irradiated that those who have survived will, as somebody famously said, pity the dead. Those who have survived will be envying the dead. So from that moment onwards, major war, total war, war involving nuclear weapons, has been seen by countries that have nuclear weapons or are confronted with countries that have nuclear weapons as something that must be avoided. Even though this hasn't been totally spelled out, for example, in Soviet strategy or in Chinese strategy, there is this underlying sense that the governments of the Soviet Union and Communist China even became more cautious in their foreign policy since nuclear weapons have been invented.
Fascinating. Yes, thank you. So now, speaking ethically, in terms of these ideas of deterrence, are nuclear weapons fundamentally different? And in terms of morality, is there something different about nuclear weapons? And has this somehow affected military strategies and deterrence?
It took a long time to work its way into strategy. Now, first of all, the moral question is one that even moral philosophers have found difficult to answer. In theory, of course, every one unjust victim of war is a tragedy. There is a point, however, where if you are unleashing a war that will carry off such a high percentage of the population, such total numbers potentially, as we've only seen in the two world wars, and possibly more than that even, that you begin to think that nothing could possibly, in a balance of evils, justify such sacrifices, such destruction. So, yes, there is an element that is simply quantitative in the morality of this, but there is also another element, another dimension, which is that unless you really have constructed a strategy in which you can target nuclear weapons ever so carefully and ensure that it really doesn't have much effect on surrounding cities, which I'm still skeptical about. You will have collateral damage affecting particularly civilians, or in any case, very many civilians. And international law and our concepts of international law have over time evolved to say that you shouldn't be killing civilians. Although this was totally standard practice in the Middle Ages and before, we have increasing, and of course, it was a terrible, large a part of the Second World War. We now think that civilians should be treated in a different way, that they should be protected. And this danger of collateral damage that actually exceeds any rationally presentable cause, just cause, is increasingly making it difficult to justify morally the use of nuclear weapons in such a context. Now, people have responded by making smaller nuclear weapons with some smaller yield and very specific nuclear weapons that have certain effects only, for example, for a short period of time. So, in theory, populations could hide in shelters, and when they come out again, the radiation would have stopped because of the way that the weapon is calibrated. Nevertheless, a lot of people are skeptical about this simply because you might assume that even a small amount of nuclear use would trigger retaliation measures by other powers, and they won't all stop to say, oh, was that a neutron bomb, or was that a so-and-so, was it a depleted uranium weapon? Let's be sure that we have the right thing before we respond. So many reasons for the moral dilemma that brings that nuclear strategy brings.
Interesting, yeah. So stepping back a little bit, looking at the overall role of technology in war, what is that role? And more specifically, does the war dictate the technology used and developed and focused on, or does the technology available to, military powers dictate what kind of and how these wars are fought?
This is a particularly brilliant question, and I thank you very much for asking it. It's a fascinating chicken and egg question to look at where technology influences the way we wage war, and to what extent the way we want to wage war determines what sort of technology we are trying to develop. Now, in the context of the Second World War and the run-up to the Second World War, strategists around the world seem to have been, or particularly in the Western world, seem to have been so convinced that it would be a mass war, that it would be a war involving entire nations mobilized entirely, that it would be something resembling a total war in this total mobilization sense, in the sense of a nation wouldn't even stop if their government had been defeated, the sort of totality of war. As a function of that, there was more and more attempts were made to develop technology which would have an extremely large firepower, or in some other way be very comprehensive in their effects on populations. Now, research, even before that, I mean, this is a sort of, you have to look at this First World War and the Second World War as a period that belongs together in that context, because a lot of these tendencies were there even before the First World War, during the First World War. The effect of this was that people were looking for ever greater firepower. And my hunch is, and that of many other people, that research would have gone in different ways if the nuclear dimension wouldn't have been successful. In fact, it did go in other ways. For example, the Germans, who had despaired of developing a nuclear weapon, developed rockets. and developed increasingly high firepower explosions created by rockets without having to sacrifice their own bomber airplanes, which were difficult to man, etc. So there were other ways like that. Chemical warfare had been explored. While it had been checked through Chemical Weapons Convention, it could very well have been unleashed again. Biological weapons were being explored. I think there were alternatives to nuclear weapons that could have been developed. But it's quite interesting that you can find times where you see that it's the technology that gives people ideas. So it's the opposite. So you have other contexts where somebody, you know, for example, the invention of gunpowder is the one that everybody always quotes. Long time ago, Chinese invented gunpowder, and the first thing they did, or what they did for centuries, was they said, oh, it makes funny and beautiful patterns in the sky when we launch it into the sky. And it was for centuries that people didn't think of saying, oh, here's a new invention, how can we use it to kill people? So it's interesting how different cultures in different contexts will home in on a new invention as, oh, how wonderful, that's something new to kill people, how could we use it? Whereas in other contexts, you have a particular situation, a particular ideology looking for a particular weapon. In the case of nuclear weapons, we can say definitely that it was a set of ideologies, in fact, but they were somehow related to this idea of totality of war that was looking for a horrible military application of something which, on the other hand, could provide peaceful energy and had all sorts of solutions for other problems which are totally morally justifiable.
That is a really fascinating connection. I didn't really think about that connection there between the uses of gunpowder and nuclear energy as well. So looking now at the civilian side, you write in your book, The Bomb, about several major, mainly civilian anti-nuclear movements. And how successful were these movements? And more importantly, for the future, is nuclear power something that can be informed or at all controlled by popular opinion?
Popular opinion always has a rather indirect way of controlling anything in all democracies which are representative democracies. It's only in Switzerland where you can, as popular population, can actually have a referendum and say we want to do X, Y, or Z with it. It's quite interesting how, particularly if you're homing in on the anti-nuclear movements of the late 50s, early 60s, and then again the very late 70s, early 80s. Interestingly enough, although they were very strong and very vocal, governments persuaded themselves that they represented a minority in their own countries. And instead of making governments more pliant at the time or willing to concede policy points and to go back on policies because big demonstrations in Whitehall and elsewhere demanded it, these governments tended to find their position strengthened, find that they were becoming less compromising and more insistent that they were going to carry this through. Governments have fallen over this, but when they were replaced, there's a particular case that I'm thinking of in Germany, the new government was even more hardline on the introduction of Euro missiles in the early 80s, for example. What's very interesting, though, is that and there seems to be a sort of human experience here. While individual human beings and collective human beings, governments, are very loath to backtrack from a policy. They will be much less inclined to try something similar at a later stage because of the lesson learned that, oh my God, that brings us into endless problems with the public. Let's not go there. So it's actually an effect once removed, and one can say a lot about how government policies have not explored certain things because of the divisiveness of the issue. So, for example, even now, or even in recent decades, Germany, for one, has avoided actually creating a national security document, a sort of national defense review or something like that, for fear of the big public debate this could engender. Let's not go there. Remember the earlier 1980s. You know, there are this sort of indirect way. Now, you can have, if a decision hasn't really been taken, if you still need Parliament to ratify it, I think in that sort of context and where there's a strong parliamentary democracy, big protest movements, etc., can have some effect. For example, in Germany, the decision of the government to quit nuclear energy production has been in part caused by big public pressure on this. But on the whole, it tends to be more indirect than direct, and it might be the, you know, the next issue that the government won't raise because of the previous protests they've experienced. But it's rarely directly a backtracking on one particular policy.
Fascinating. Yeah. And speaking for, you know, current anti-nuclear movements, is there a future for the overall international abolishment of nuclear weapons, or is the requisite political trust that would be needed between countries simply beyond reach?
The trust is beyond reach. The question is, can ways be found of verification that can substitute for the trust, can substitute hard knowledge for the trust? And it's really in that area that people have so far not, scientists have so far not produced satisfactory answers. There is still this whole concern of, you know, if we relinquish our nuclear weapons, and even if we all got to a stage where we have a nuclear weapon that we could assemble in the basement overnight, but for the moment we will show that it's in different components and we're not putting it together and we're making this open to verification. There is that concern that there is some cave somewhere or some bunker somewhere where the adversary is already doing this and then they're preparing an advanced strike. The problem there, so international abolition of nuclear weapons is as what we're all committed to, but I think that if pushed, you would find that different governments have a different time span of what they want to achieve or where they think this might go, where with the majority of the current nuclear powers thinking, not in my lifetime, let's just keep saying it. There is one country that could go really, in my view, forfeit nuclear weapons and really could substitute every function of a nuclear weapon that is desirable in a conflict with something better, with something non-nuclear, and that is the US. And I think we came quite close with President Obama when he was beginning to sympathize with this idea and had realized that all sorts of things like earth-penetrating weapons, fuel air explosives, etc., could in fact do the job, the military job, that we want nuclear weapons to do in an equally good or better way. I'm using the word good in the sense of effectively. But of course, as he didn't cross the line, he couldn't then trigger all the or put pressure on all the other countries to follow suit. Because there are reasons for having nuclear weapons that you can say there are bits that only a nuclear weapon can do. For example, the destruction of a chemical or biological weapons plant to the point, particularly biological, to the point where you don't just bomb the thing and then the terrible ingredients, the viruses or whatever, are spread over all the world, but they're burnt and completely destroyed on the spot. That's something that perhaps only a nuclear weapon can do, perhaps a fuel air explosive. But there are things for which military people wanted nuclear weapons and where there was in the past no substitute, but over the last 2-3 decades, substitutes have been developed, so there's no reason to cling on to them for those military purposes. And if you're the United States, you're strong enough to have all sorts of other assets that you can use for deterrent and war waging purposes.
Thank you. That's fascinating and a really good point there. So getting now towards the end of the interview, I have a really difficult question for you, but you asked the question in your book of, have nuclear weapons abolished major or total war? Can you speak a little bit more about that? And I know it's a hard question to answer, but...
It is indeed. Let me start with definitions, the difference between a major war and a total war and how the two terms have been used. Let me just say that total war should really only be used in one of two senses. And when I'm saying this is I'm being a pedant, I know, but I think it's useful to agree on definitions there. Otherwise, we're talking past each other. One definition of total war is the total mobilization of one's own economy and society. And you've had a lot of that, not in totally entirely, not 100%, but you had a lot of that in the First and the Second World Wars. So from that point of view, you could still imagine that societies are very extensively mobilized for war. In the Iran-Iraq War, you could say that both societies were, to a very large extent, mobilized. Total 100% is always a bit sort of an abstract ideal. In reality, there's always a little bit of other things going on. But from that point of view, major war and total war has occurred even since 1945. But there's another definition of total war, which was introduced by somebody called Erich Ludendorff, who was a German general, and he wrote this book on total war in 1936. And for him, total war is the attempt totally to annihilate the enemy population. Totally to annihilate enemy population, that means Holocaust, that means starving them all to death, that means, and the effect of that, which the Nazi party put into practice, was 27 million Soviet citizens in the areas occupied by Germany dead, you know, including mainly civilians. So that is much more than just mobilization on your own side, it's genocide. From that point of view, there is a huge difference between total war and major war. So major war doesn't have to be genocidal at all. Now, major war, from the point of view of America, the Vietnam War was not a major war. It was even called a limited war, a small war. But from the point of view of the Vietnamese, that was total war to some extent. You know, that it was total in the sense that there was an almost genocidal elements of it, because there was an attempt to eradicate anybody who was of the other political opinion, etc. The Korean War was a tremendously major, if not total, war for the Koreans, even if it was something that was happening far, far away and only professional soldiers went there for some of the countries in the coalition fighting against it. So if we simply lower our regard and don't just think of everything of major war exclusively as World War II, then has not only happened since 1945, but it is sadly imaginable that it can still happen. The hope is simply that this escalation to a level which would involve nuclear weapons, and if nuclear weapons are used against cities, I wouldn't hesitate to call that genocide. Although we can debate until the cows come home about the precise meaning of it, but if you kill lots and lots and lots of civilians, I think that'd be difficult not to call it that. Our hope is that nuclear weapons will continue to keep a lid on that, and that whatever sides are involved in a war would be cautious not to allow it to go to that level.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a good point. And I hadn't thought about that that difference, particularly in perspective, from a perspective of someone like me reading about wars like the Vietnam War and Korean War versus those who, you know, experienced it and see it as something much more total than how I see it. And so my last question, which is speaking to a younger audience, how do you see nuclear power affecting policies and people in the future? And what should young people be concerned about? And what can they do for the future of, you know, nuclear disarmament and the like?
I am actually concerned about young people from one point of view. It's not so much of what should young people be concerned about. I'm concerned that young people don't have enough experience or a living memory passed on to them from people who have been eyewitnesses or have lived through the Second World War, and in the background, the experience of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the shock when it began to dawn on them what that had meant for the populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that there isn't enough of that direct linkage any longer, and that young people, particularly in non-Western cultures that have not been so directly involved in the last World War, will simply not be told how absolutely horrible that was and how that must not be repeated. So my real concern is how anybody in your generation who feels strongly about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because perhaps they've learned about it at school or from their great-grandparents if they're still alive, or from a visit even to Hiroshima or something like that, how they can share with people in India, with people in African countries, with people in the Muslim world, with people in Latin America, the horror of this, so that it can continue to be that taboo. So that people can continue to think of it as a never again, rather than I hate those other people so much that I would wish this on them. You see? And I think one of the real dangers there is that emotion and the sort of the hatred and the immediate, those are my enemies, and they have done all these terrible things to us, let's nuke them. We've got them. We've got nukes. Let's do it. Wins out over the, oh my goodness, what a horrible thing happened to mankind, to humanity, and we couldn't possibly ever in any context condone children being made to suffer that, unarmed people being made to suffer that. And even for armed people, this is not something we can possibly go along with. It is so totally full of suffering that we can't be part of that. That's my concern. So the danger really is that a few of you in your generation know about this, sense this, have picked this up from the older generations, from reading about it. How can you communicate this to people in your own generation? That, I suppose, is your great mission.
Thank you so much. That's such a fascinating answer to that question. Thank you so much, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, and I just wish you all the strength and the persuasiveness to share this message and also your concerns about the spread of small arms with your peers. And thank you for asking me to come along.
I will do my best. Thank you.